James chapter 1, verse 13. And this is an important principle to remember when you think about God, especially when things aren't going your way, when difficult things happen in your life. It says here, let no one say when he is tempted. You know, and we all can be tempted. We can all be tempted. We are all tempted at various times. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. God isn't the tempter. Satan is the tempter. And God does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. So we know that Satan is there, and Satan does his level best to tempt us, to seek to entice us. He knows our weaknesses. He knows those things that we can fall prey to, and he tends to send them our way in order to tempt and entice us. And unfortunately, we may be weak, and we can give in to those temptations or to those desires. It says in verse 15, then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. So the thought leads to the sin leads to death. It's a process. So if we don't understand this very important point that God is not the tempter, then we're not going to get the lesson that's involved here as it applies to us and our lives. It's good to remember that these people, Joseph, all his brothers, and Jacob, did not know what they were going through. They didn't see it. They didn't understand it fully. They did not know what they were going through when they went through it. They didn't see it from God's perspective. And sometimes that's hard for us to do. So how does James 1, verses 13 and 14 apply? How did this thing that we're dealing with Joseph, begin? This whole adventure that's portrayed for us in Genesis began because of sin. It began because of sin. God did not make these people sin, but sin precipitated the events that unfold. So you have to realize Jacob did not have to flee to Syria unless he sinned. He sinned, therefore he flees. He gets to the land that he's going to, and he sees Rachel. She's a good-looking young woman, and unfortunately, he says, I'll work 7 years for her, and then other sins ensue. And it's sin began this whole process. And in this process, God did not tempt anyone. He didn't force people to live by faith either. That was an option, but he didn't force it. Instead, what we see is how God is able to turn bad attitudes, foolish choices, and even terrible sins of people involved into a result that is beneficial in the long run to everyone concerned. Only God can do that. Only God can work something like that out. It's beneficial to God's plan and also to people's well-being, even though it may be very difficult while they're experiencing it. You have to realize God, as we're going through difficulties, God isn't tempting us. He may be allowing us to be tested. But testing is different than temptation. You see, temptation, the end result that the tempter wants is you to fail. When God allows you to be tested, God said, I want you to face this test. And I hope you ace it. I hope you ace it because that's the outcome that I want for you to be successful. It's not for you to stumble and fall. So even when the incident was over and Israel and all his family was safe, you know, they'd gone through this whole process and they were safely in Egypt and protected from the famine. Neither Jacob nor Joseph understood the spiritual implications of what the family had gone through. They didn't see it fully. They saw the physical implications, but they did not see the spiritual implications. They didn't understand that there was a great spiritual purpose that was being worked out. And we can understand because we can look back. We can read the scriptures and we can see the great purpose that was being worked out. But if we'd been in their position, walking in their shoes, we wouldn't have seen it either. We wouldn't have seen it either. And that's something we have to realize, is that God has given us that understanding that in our lives, whatever we've gone through up to this point, did it all have no point, no purpose? We learned nothing from it? Only if we choose not to learn from it. Only if we choose not to say, you know what, I made some mistakes. I made some wrong turns. But I know that this is all going to work for my greater good. That God was involved because God has called me and opened my mind to certain spiritual truths. Both Joseph and Jacob believed the promises. They believed God's promises. But this is at the end of their experience. You know, like when Jacob is on his way up to Syria to stay with his uncle, he basically tells God, look, you help everything to work out and I'm right with you. He wasn't acting in faith. Basically, he said, you come through, God, and I'll do my part then. So he was putting the ball in God's court when he should have been saying, God, you know, I'm going to respond to you. Jacob had some things to learn. They believed that Joseph had been used by God. They believed that they had been the recipients of God's gracious gift. And Jacob and Joseph believed that the family would return to Canaan. And why was that? Because they knew the promise of Genesis chapter 15. They knew that Abraham had been given that promise, and that promise would be fulfilled. But they did not clearly see the totality of what God had worked through them. So they believed the promise that God had given to Abraham, but they didn't see its full implications. To me, it's incredible that God is able to use people as he did here. God used Jacob's entire family, developing their character, correcting and punishing, bringing about repentance, producing vital lessons that were written down for our edification, things that we can learn from. And God was involved in this the whole way through, and yet he never took away their free moral agency. So what you have is God says, I'm going to work this plan out, and I am going to bring you back. I'm going to bring you down to Egypt, and eventually, after 400 years, I'm going to bring you back to the land of promise. I'm going to work out my purpose, and you're going to have free moral agency. You're going to be able to make choices for yourself through the whole process. That's a pretty remarkable thing, that God can accomplish his purpose and yet never, ever force us in a particular direction. You will go this direction or else, or take over our lives and force us. He doesn't do that. Did you know that if God takes away someone's free moral agency, then he would have no basis for judging? If God controls you, and it is God forcing you to do whatever that's worthy of praise, you know, he can't make a judgment and praise you. Or how could God ever blame you if he is the one forcing you to do it? You're an automaton. He's just moving you. But that's not the way it is. So we have to ask, how can God either praise and reward or blame and punish if he has taken over control of any of us? And he hasn't done that. He gives us free moral agency. We are not puppets. We are not puppets, and he just pulls the string and we move around. We're not puppets. And God holds us, you know, if we were puppets, then God couldn't hold us responsible. But God does hold us responsible because he does not force us to do anything. It's a free choice. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Now you may be saying, well, we aren't spending much time on Joseph. Well, we are, but in an indirect way. Because there's principles in Joseph's life that we can learn from. Principles that we can apply in our lives. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9. It says, "Therefore we make it our aim, whether present or absent, to be well-pleasing to Him." So it's our goal, our purpose, to be well-pleasing to Him who is Jesus Christ. "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that the things each one may receive, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad." So each one of us must appear before the throne of Christ. That's every one of us. We will appear before the judgment seat of Christ. And judgment's being discussed, and he's telling us, you know, since we're all going to have to stand before the judgment seat, we have to think about what we're doing or what we're not doing. Because we're going to have to stand there, and he's going to say, "Well, how did things go?" Okay, I think. And he says, "Are you sure?" And then we're going to say, "Well, maybe not as well as I thought." And we're going to have to answer. So he's saying, you know, you might take into consideration that since you're going to have to stand before him, that it may be a good idea to do those things that are well-pleasing to him. And that's the point that Paul is making. We're going to be judged based on the choices that we make, whether they're good or they're bad. We have to answer for those things, and we're responsible for them. Let's go to down to verse 14, 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Verse 14. It says, "For the love of Christ compels us." The love of Christ gives us impetus. It compels us. It gives us a push, in a sense, a strong desire to go in a certain direction. So it says, "For the love of Christ compels us, because we judge thus, that if one died for all, then all die." You know, that, you know, Christ died for everyone, then we all died. We all died to sin as a result of Christ's death. "Then all died, and he died for all, that those who live should live no longer for themselves." You see, the price has been paid for our sins, and he says we should no longer just live selfishly, just live for ourselves and what we want. And that's a hard thing for us to do humanly, to say, you know what, I surrender to you, God, and I want to do what is pleasing to you. But we should live no longer just for ourselves, but for him who died for them and rose again. You see, the way that we live should reflect that we accept the sacrifice of Christ, that we accept and we value the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and that we feel compelled to respond to the love of God that is shed abroad in our heart, and to allow that love to flow out from us toward others. So even though we have known Christ according to the flesh, yet now we know him thus no longer. So we know him in a way that where God's Spirit dwells in us, where it's not just a fleshly knowledge, but it's something spiritual. I believe that one of the reasons that the story of Joseph is in the Bible is not just because he was used by God to fulfill a major portion of a great promise, but I believe it's in there because here was a man who had an extremely high batting average when it came to making the right choices. He didn't make those choices because he was lucky. He didn't make those choices because he was lucky. Joseph considered his options, and he deliberately made right choices, regardless of the consequences to himself. And he did it repeatedly. He made the right choice, regardless of the consequence. He made the right choice not because he was lucky, but because he saw it was the right thing to do, and he did it. If we had no free moral agency, Judgment by God would be totally unfair, but God is not unfair, and he judges according to the law, and he judges fairly. Let's think about one more thing regarding the making of choices. That is here in 2 Corinthians 5, and in most specifically in verse 10, where it talks about our being before the judgment seat of Christ. Now, how many of you see going before the judgment seat of Christ as a positive? It's kind of like going to the principal's office, isn't it? There's stress, pressure. Oh, man, what did I do now? You know, so, I mean, if I've been to the principal's office, and I know on the way down there, I'm thinking, oh, man, how's this going to go? And always worried about it. In high school, my name was Gary M. Smith. In my high school, there was a Gary L. Smith. Now, I was a good boy. But Gary L., he had some problems, and he was visiting with the vice principal fairly often. And several times, I got to go down there, and he'd look at me and say, not the right kid. So they'd call the other Gary Smith down there and give him the raspberries. But anyway, every time I went down there, I always wondered what was going to happen. Sometimes it was justified, but most of the time, you know, I was okay. But we all, as we think about going before the judgment seat of Christ, we worry about it. But you know what? The Bible does not present that as a negative thing. The Bible, yes, says you're going to have to answer. But what's God's goal? God's goal is that you're going to meet the test. So when you come before the judgment seat of Jesus Christ, what's he going to say? Well done, good and faithful servant. You know, and as we hear those words, we're all going to wipe our hand across our brow and think, oh, baby, things are all good. I've got a long and wonderful future ahead of me. So God, to go before the judgment seat of Christ is not something negative. It's not something that we should dread. Because you see, God is doing his work in us. And don't we have the same choices that Joseph did? Joseph made considered decisions. And he repeatedly made the right decision. And that's what God wants us to do as well. But we have to also realize that's a privilege that we've been given. Joseph was given. But we've not. But most of the world has not been given that. We've been given that, but the world, they don't have that privilege yet. That privilege will come later. So now, when does our judgment take place? Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 17. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 17. Let's look at verse 17. It says, for the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God? So our judgment is taking place right now, it tells us. For those of us who have been called out of the world and we are in the church, we are being judged now. God is judging us. And so God is judging us. Let's tie this in with the story of Joseph. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 2. Just back a little bit and look at verses 11 and 12. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. It says, beloved, so he's speaking to members of the church, and he says, beloved, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust. Abstain from fleshly lust. And because we have a choice in this regard, whether to participate in or abstain from fleshly lust. It is a choice. And he's saying, don't make a choice that is based upon selfishness and get and covetousness. Don't make such a choice. And it tells us that we're to abstain from fleshly lust, which war against the soul. And if you are involved in a war, what is one of the outcomes that can occur when you're involved in a conflict? If you're involved in a war, people get killed. So he's telling us that these fleshly lusts war against the soul. And if we don't deal with them in the right way and we don't overcome them, then it says that they can war against the soul and we can lose our lives. We can be killed. He says, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, having your conduct as a Christian, as one of God's called out ones, one who is being judged now. The Gentiles are not being judged now. That when they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works by the way that you conduct yourself, which they shall observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. Now, the word I'd like to focus on here in all of this is visitation. What does that mean? Visitation. The day of visitation. Visitation means to look over, to inspect, to consider, to examine. And what was happening to the people to whom Peter was writing in this epistle? They were being persecuted. They were being persecuted by family. They were being persecuted by friends. They were being persecuted by people in their neighborhoods, people in their city, people in authority. And persecutors are not going to glorify God while they hate God and while they are persecuting His representatives, His people. They're not going to glorify God. They may mistakenly believe they're even doing God a service by persecuting the people of God. Were Joseph, if you should think about Joseph, were his brothers glorifying God while they were doing what they were doing to that young man? Were they glorifying God? Absolutely not. They were acting on their carnal nature. Joseph was God's chosen representative or instrument for delivering Jacob's family into a physical salvation, into Egypt. And when did Joseph's brothers glorify God? Did they ever glorify God, Joseph's brothers? Did they ever glorify God? To the extent that they did it in the day of their visitation. And the day of their visitation was when they came face to face with the brother that they had sold into slavery, Joseph. You don't think they were all perspiring just a touch when they realized who they were talking to? Oops, this is Joseph. This could go badly. Especially if he's kind of a vengeful sort. I'm sure they were worried. But when they, you know, at that point they had to come face to face with what they had done. The day of visitation is the day in which people are judged. The day people are judged. So these persecutors are not going to glorify God until it is their time to be looked over, inspected, examined. Then they're going to glorify God. And how do we fit into this scenario in the same way that Joseph did? You know, we can't separate ourselves from this story. It's not just a story about Joseph. It's a story about you and me, because we're going to be the saviors of the world in the not too distant future as we serve Jesus Christ. We're going to help save people from their sins in the day of their visitation. We're being prepared for that now. We're going to help them to come to see their sins and their need for repentance and their recognition of where they've gone wrong. So there's much to learn from Joseph and what he had to go through as a result of the persecution of his brothers. Let's go to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. Let's look at verse 33. Romans 8, verse 33. It says, "Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies." So as you think about Joseph, was he charged? Yes, he was. He was accused. What about Christians? Are they charged? Sometimes we are. And who are they charged by? The word indicates somebody called to account for what they are. And that's what happens when somebody makes a charge against us. They call us Christians, followers of Jesus Christ. They're not being charged by Jesus Christ. They're being charged by those who are persecuting us. And that day may come sooner than we know. Verse 34 says, "Who is he who condemns? It is Christ who died." And what is Paul saying here? He says, "Look, brethren, to whom do we have to give account? They may be charging us, but to whom do we have to give account? To our persecutors or to Jesus Christ?" They may be charging with us with whatever because we follow Christ, but bring the charges and they really are inconsequential because the one we have to answer to is Jesus Christ. At the end of verse 34 and beginning of verse 35, it says, "And furthermore, is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword?" Do you think those things went through Joseph's mind as he went through the trials that he went through? What was going through his head as he was in the pit? What was in his head as he was sold to the Ishmaelites into slavery? And then he was bought as a household slave. And he served in that household. And then he does what is right and he ends up back in prison again. What was going through his head? He had every right to say, "I'm innocent. I'm innocent. I didn't do these things." Verse 36. It says, "For your sake we are killed all the day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord." And it's good to remember this. Because we can all suffer persecution for one reason or another. Because we seek to serve Jesus Christ. And as we go through those things, it's good to keep these things in mind and to keep the overall perspective in mind that God doesn't tempt us. He may allow us to be tested. But God in our lives is working out a great purpose. That what we're facing and what we're dealing with is for His great purpose. Sometimes we're dealing with difficult people at work. We have difficult bosses. We have people that are difficult to work with and are challenging. And it's not fun. To go to work is a trial. And it's hard to keep these things in perspective when we lose focus. But if we realize God's working out a great purpose, I'm involved in it. I've been called out. And what this is all going to be for my good in the end. And that I don't have to answer the people that are giving me a difficult time. I have to answer to Christ. And so my conduct must be according to the way He's instructed me so that I will be well-pleasing to Him when I come before Him. Even as with Joseph, there was much more than met the eye on the surface. And these people did not know what they were going through until it was over. And, you know, people try to figure out, well, why is this happening to me? Well, why is this happening? I can't tell you. You probably will never figure it out until maybe you can see why at the end. But many times we won't even see then. We have to just trust that God is working in our lives and working out His great purpose in us. Now, let's go back to Genesis chapter 37 and we'll focus on verse 3. And you don't have to turn there, but I'll read what the part we want to focus on. In verse 3 it says, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children." Now, if you're a parent, that's a recipe for disaster. If you love one child more than the other, they tend to recognize it, and it tends to cause difficulty in the family. But Jacob could not see this. He couldn't see that that Rachel being his favorite caused problems. And he didn't see that loving Joseph more than the other boys caused a problem either. But God used these events to fulfill His prophecy in Genesis 15. And we know that Joseph gave to Jacob a coat of many colors. And all this coat did was to emphasize to the other brothers, this is the favored son. Because they all quickly recognized, we didn't get one of those neat coats. I mean, when he gave it to Joseph, he just gave it to Joseph. And the other boys are there and they're like, where's our coat? And it's very obvious who's favored. Now, if you had got them, I mean, my parents, they tended to get my brother and I the same stuff. So if I got, a cowboy hat, He got a cowboy hat. If I got a football, he got a football. So we both got the same stuff. No complaining. It was all cheap stuff too, but we both got the same stuff. But that tends to solve a lot of problems. But this coat tended to just rub the fact that Joseph was the favored son into the wound. Oh, we'll pour a little salt in there and rub it in real good and make it sting. So it's doubtful that Jacob did this deliberately, but he just didn't see it. It was a blind spot in his life. And, you know, as you look at all of this, Jacob was favored one over the other. But in all of these challenges that were going on in this family, as we look at Joseph, we see that he was a cut above his brothers in virtually every way. He was a cut above them spiritually, a cut above them morally, intellectually, ethically. And when he spent time with them working together with his brothers, Joseph could see that there was a difference in approach between the way he would do it and the way they were doing it. They were older, they had their way, and he could see that there were two different approaches. As you look at Joseph, he approached and carried out his responsibilities with wisdom and diligence and even in brilliance. And this was recognized by his employers. It was unusual that you would hire a slave and in a short time he's running your household. It wasn't because he was a deadbeat slouch and didn't know anything. It was because he was benefiting his master. And his master could see that he could trust him, and what he gave him to do, he would do. And so that's the person you tend to give responsibilities to. And even in Joseph's youth, he had these qualities going for him. And I think we can only assume that the other sons did not have the same qualities. You know, as Joseph was out working with him, he noted that they were not doing what they were supposed to do, what his father wanted them to do. And what did he do? He made note of it. But the boys, young men he was working with, they basically say, what does it matter? Dad's not here to see what we're doing. He's not here to look at it. We'll just do what we want. And they did. And Joseph made note of it. And so he went back, and what did he do? He told his dad. And how did this help the brothers' view of Jacob? Well, they all already saw him as Joseph's favorite. Now he's a tattletale ratting us out to our dad. And basically he's a drag on the way we do things. I mean, everything was going along well, and this, he comes in here and tattletales to our dad. As we look at this, it's easy for us to conclude that Joseph's just a spoiled brat, tattletale. But is that in actuality the way he was? Let's go back and think about here just for a minute. You know, we may be able to look at this in a little bit different way. Let's consider the attitude of the brothers earlier in the story. Weren't the brothers, Simeon and Levi, the two brothers who acted in anger and vengeance and raw carnality and went in and killed all the men in Shechem? I mean, that's a pretty serious step to take, to kill all the men in a town. But that's exactly what they did. And then the other fine, upstanding brothers, when they find out all authority is gone, what did they say? No authority. We can loot, pillage, and plunder and take everything for ourselves, which is exactly what they did. So as you look at Joseph's older brothers, what kind of character do we see on display? There isn't much. They're carnal, vengeful. With these carnal attitudes, should we be surprised that they hated their brother? Should we be surprised that they had no qualms about selling Joseph into slavery? Should we be surprised at their willingness to deceive their father? None of them owned up to their action. Even when they saw their father in anguish, they were so hard-hearted they wouldn't tell him. For many people, that would move them to break down and say, well, we just have to admit what we did. but they would not do it. Now contrast that with what the Bible later reveals about Joseph's character, and the contrast is pretty clear. Maybe Joseph being a tattletale was justified. Let's consider Leviticus chapter 5, verse 1. Leviticus chapter 5, verse 1. Here it says, if a person sins in hearing the utterance of an oath, so you hear someone utter an oath, you hear someone swear, and is a witness, whether he has seen or known of the matter, if he does not tell it, he bears guilt. So if you hear someone swear, and you keep that to yourself, you don't share that with anyone, then that's a sin that's taken place. But you don't say anything to anyone about it, then you bear guilt. That's a biblical principle. That's not an Old Testament principle. That's a biblical principle, and it's still very much in effect today. So, it's a principle, basically you are an accomplice. You are an accomplice. And the law says if you've been a witness to something, you hear it, you do not report it, you bear the sin. Yes, the other person is guilty of the sin because they committed it. They uttered the words, but you're guilty because you let it go. So, however, if being a witness is, sometimes we might think, well, I know the person. It's my brother. It's my family member. I can't rat them out. Or it's my friend. Somebody that I'm close to. I can't rat them out. I can't reveal what I found. And it is emotionally difficult to do that. But consider this in the case of Joseph and his brothers. They're in the same family, and hardly anybody in a family wants to be the bad guy. I'm sure Joseph felt a lot of pressure on him not to report his brothers. And the way the brothers looked at what Joseph did, he was the bad guy. He was the problem, not their actions. And why? Because he told their father of something evil that they had done. So, as you think about it, if nobody ever reported things that were done, would the police ever arrest anybody? It would be rare to have them arrest anybody. But they arrest somebody as they have people turn them in. Well, I saw so-and-so doing such and such. Oh, really? So that, and if there were nobody willing to turn anybody in for a crime, you think the world's bad now? It would be quite bad because nobody would ever be arrested. You know, unless the police happened to stumble on, hit them with their car, maybe they would not be arresting many people. So now as to understanding Leviticus 5 verse 1, we don't want to just focus on the example that's given, which is the example of somebody swearing. Now, that is used only to give an example of one being a witness to something that may be done. And that is the kind of atmosphere most crimes are done in. They're done in secret, aren't they? They're done in the dark. I would say when they stole the copper out of our wiring out here, they didn't do it in the daytime. Unless it was this center point energy making a special run and picking up a few extra bucks on the side, which I doubt. So they probably did it at night. Isn't that's correct? They do it at night. It's when most crimes are committed. So if people think that somebody is watching them, they're much less likely to do that which is evil. And so God is saying that it is the duty of a person to report wrongdoing. And if the person does not, he bears the sin with him. He's an accomplice. Now, I want us to see how strong this sense of personal responsibility is in the Bible. It's the responsibility both to God and to the community. It was Joseph's responsibility to his family and to God to report what he saw. And we know that's the same thing in the church. We are our brother's keeper, and we should if we see something, we should do something about it. And the reason we do it is because a little leaven leavens the whole lump. You don't just let it go. So if crime or sin is not stopped at its source quickly, it's going to spread. And if someone sees something done in sin or a crime, God holds that person accountable to do something about it. In many cases in the church, what is the best thing to do? It's something that's rarely done, but it's the best thing to do. You notice the problem and you go to the person and you speak to the person directly and you deal with it. You deal with it with them. Nobody else is involved, and hopefully that takes care of it. That takes care of it. The people take it to heart and they say, you know what, you're right, I was wrong. And they come to repentance and they move forward. They're benefited and you're benefited and the church is benefited. Because you've done what you should do. And that's the best way to take care of things. That's the way God set into the church as a process for alleviating these problems. Let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5. Now let's go to Genesis 37 for time's sake here. Genesis 37. Now, as you think about that spiritual principle of being an accomplice, of noticing something and taking care of it, what do you think about what Joseph did in that light? It puts it in a whole different light. That he wasn't just a spoiled brat tattletale. He actually was a person who was concerned for his brothers, who loved his father and wanted what was best for the family. And it begins to look to me like Joseph had some pretty good spiritual training. Somebody had taught him some spiritual principles, and they were pretty well embedded in his life at 17 years of age. So he did what he was responsible before God to do. And once he did this, once he told on his brothers, what happened to him? They all went to him and said, "Thank you, Joseph, for letting us know that we were not right." Isn't that what happened? Oh, it wasn't. What happened was, he was hated more than ever. They hated him more intensely. I could ask for a show of hands, how many of you have gone to your brother and spoken to them, and it backfired on you? I would say most of us have had that experience, and we said, enough of that. So we quit doing what we should do. But I'm not your first line of defense. You are. And it is your responsibility to go to the person and seek to resolve it at the lowest level possible. And when you go to them, it's not something you talk to other people about. You deal with the one person and that one person alone, and nobody else has to know. That's what's called covering sin. Nobody else has to know. You're not putting up with sin. You're not allowing it. You know it took place and you're trying to deal with it. And there are other things you can do if resolving at the lowest level doesn't work out. So it backfired on him, and his brothers hated him all the more. It was really the outcome you would expect, since the brothers were so carnally motivated. And we see that there are two spirits at war with one another. Whenever the Spirit of God does something right, the spirit of the world hates it. And so don't expect the world to pat you on the back for doing what's right. Remember Jesus' warning that whenever men speak well of you, you better take heed, because in all probability it's an indication you've made friends with the world. And that's not what we want to do. You can see that at a very, very early age, Joseph was showing inclinations that he was going to put God, God's word, God's laws, even the friendship of his own brothers in a secondary position to God. So he put God first. He put God's words and his laws first. And can you see what's happening with Joseph? Joseph is becoming more and more of a stumbling block to his brothers. Not because he was evil, but because he was good. And they were being condemned by it. And what happens when a person is condemned by somebody who's good, and they recognize that this person is doing what's right, and making me look bad. They tend to be unhappy with you, and it's easy to become persecuted. So is all of this beginning to teach us something about Christ? Put Christ in the place of Joseph. Christ was killed not because he was a sinner or a bad man. He was killed because he was a good man. He condemned people by his righteousness. He didn't have to say anything. By the way that he lived, he condemned people. He lived a holy life. He lived a life that was good. And people could not stand the comparison. They would say he's a good man. He's going around doing good things, but they couldn't stand what he stood for, even though they may have liked him. So Christ himself said that he was going to be a stumbling block for many, and he was, just by the way he lived. And the words that he spoke were good, and people unfortunately sought to condemn him. So in Genesis 37, verse 4, it says, "But when his brothers saw that his fathers loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak to him." Think of the tension in that family. They hated Joseph and they couldn't even say a good thing to him. You don't think the mothers recognized this? You don't think Jacob recognized this? And Joseph most emphatically knew what was going on. And you know, the amazing thing is, what all of this hatred directed toward Joseph did, it drove the father and the son even closer together. As you look in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 10, it says, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. Because if sinners entice you and you consent, what happens? They're enticing you. They want you to join with them, go along with them." Now, could Joseph have alleviated the hatred that his brothers had for him? Absolutely. It would have been simple. All he had to do was go along. All he had to do was approach things the same way his brothers did. Just join in with them. To cave on his principles and his values and go right along with them. And he would have fit right in and they would have left him alone. In fact, they probably would have come to love him. "Man, we love that guy Joseph. He's out there and we're watching the cattle and he's right with us." But Joseph was unwilling to do that. The warning in the Proverbs is, don't allow yourselves to be enticed. And that's the lesson of Joseph. Joseph would not be enticed. And it's a lesson to every young person in the church. You will be enticed. Don't allow anybody to entice you to compromise right principles. So all Joseph had to do was be a good guy to become like them, and he would be accepted. But he refused that acceptance. Joseph had something very powerful going for him, and I'm absolutely certain that this enabled him to stay the course. At the same time, it brought pain, separation, and alienation from his brothers. And do you know what it was? What do you think it was? It was the love that he had for his father. Joseph loved his father. And he held to his principles. And as you look at this, we can see the parallel with Jesus Christ. Though despised and rejected of men, he stayed the course because of his Father's love. And who did he depend on when he was up against the wall? He depended upon his Father. And the love of his Father saw him through. And not only did Joseph have his physical father, but he had his father in heaven as well. And they saw him through. So God intervened and he actually intensified the feelings all around. And things were going to get worse before they got better. So here he's in the household and there's all this dysfunction and all this strife and tension. And God said, guess what? Now Joseph doesn't know this. It's going to get worse. What? I've already endured so much. It's going to get worse. And it's going to go on for a while. And this whole matter is compounded by what we find in Genesis 37, verse 5. Let's go to Genesis 37, verse 5. Genesis 37, verse 5. This made things worse. It says, now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf rose up and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And the brothers said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. So, that's the first dream, and the second one is like it, beginning in verse 9. Then he dreamed still another dream, and told it to his brothers, and said, look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bow down to me. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? So he receives a sharp rebuke from his father. And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So yes, Jacob rebuked him, but he kept it in mind in case there was something that was going to work out in regard to this dream. And you know, it's interesting, why did Joseph reveal these dreams in this way? It was because he was feeling superior? My thought is, Joseph dreamed the dreams and they were very vivid. And there's something that he found to be amazing and startling. And what did he want to do? He wanted to reveal them what he had dreamed. There's no malicious intent. He was just sharing with them. He's a 17-year-old boy and he's sharing this with his family. And he's upbraided for it. They had really made an impression on him, but it just made things worse. But Jacob remembered. Jacob remembered. If you look into Christ's story in Luke chapter 2, the situation where they're at the Feast of the Passover, and Christ is there talking to the people, the religious leaders, and they come back and get him, and he tells his mom, I'm about my father's business. And also the situation at Cana when he was turned the water to wine. In both situations, things took place and Mary kept all these things in her heart. She remembered them. Maybe there's something significant in what's taking place here. So the brother's reply or interpretation was emotional. It was hasty and it was completely carnal. And Jacob's thought, though, was at least the product of a mind that showed some measure of humility and faith. And he was learning how to allow God's hand in his life. But Joseph was revealing these dreams, and unfortunately it made things worse. One thing, we're going to end with this today. Now, why were the two dreams virtually the same? Why did God reveal two dreams that were virtually the same? This not only happened in this situation with the dreams that Joseph revealed to his family, but they happened with the butler's dream and the baker's dream were virtually the same. They had different outcomes, but they were virtually the same. And you look at the Pharaoh's two dreams, they were virtually the same. They were very similar, but had different meanings by just adjusting a little part of the dream. Why is it that God had revealed two dreams like that? Let's go to Genesis chapter 41 and look at verse 32. Genesis chapter 41, verse 32. It says, and the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God and God will shortly bring it to pass. Why did he have those two dreams like that? Joseph didn't understand a great deal, but by the time that he's revealing these dreams to Pharaoh, 13 years have gone by. Time and experience and maturity and revelation have taught him a great deal. And the doubling of dreams was God's way of emphasizing. God's way of emphasizing. He was emphasizing that the process leading to the dream's fulfillment was going to occur very quickly. So Joseph is saying that the matter is already settled in God's mind, and he's going to bring it about quickly. There's nothing we can do to turn it about. And so these things are going to happen. Now, before we go into another portion of Joseph's experiences and their meaning to us, we're going to break it off for today, and we'll pick this up at a later date.